Disc 4.
Chapter 10, Pip and Emma. Miss Blacklock listened to him this time with more attention. She was an intelligent woman, as he had known, and she grasped the implications of what he had to tell her. "Yes," she said quietly, "that does alter things. No one had any right to meddle with that door. Nobody has meddled with it, to my knowledge." "You see what it means," the inspector urged. "When the lights went out, anybody in this room the other night could have slipped out of that door, come up behind Rudy Shirts, and fired at you."
"Without being seen or heard or noticed?"
"Without being seen or heard or noticed. Remember, when the lights went out, people moved, exclaimed, bumped into each other. And after that, all that could be seen was the blinding light of the electric torch." Miss Blacklock said slowly,
"And you believe that one of those people, one of my nice commonplace neighbours, slipped out and tried to murder me?"
"Me? But why?
For goodness sake, why?"
"I've a feeling you must know the answer to that question, Miss Blacklock."
"But I don't, Inspector. I can assure you I don't."
"Well, let's make a start. Who gets your money if you were to die?" Miss Blacklock said rather reluctantly,
"Patrick and Julia. I've left the furniture in this house and a small annuity to Bunny. Really, I've not much to leave. I had holdings in German and Italian securities which became worthless, and what with taxation and the lower percentages that are now paid on invested capital, I can assure you I am not worth murdering. I put most of my money into an annuity about a year ago."
"Still, you have some income, Miss Blacklock, and your nephew and niece would come into it."
"And so Patrick and Julia would plan to murder me? I simply don't believe it. They're not desperately hard up or anything like that."
"Do you know that for a fact?"
"Well, no. I suppose I only know it from what they've told me. But I really refuse to suspect them. Some day I might be worth murdering, but not now."
"What do you mean by some day you might be worth murdering, Miss Blacklock?" Inspector Craddock pounced on the statement.
"Simply that one day, possibly quite soon, I may be a very rich woman."
"That sounds interesting. Will you explain?"
"Certainly. You may not know it, but for more than 20 years I was secretary to and closely associated with Randall Girdler."
Craddock was interested. Randall Girdler had been a big name in the world of finance. His daring speculations and the rather theatrical publicity with which he surrounded himself had made him a personality not quickly forgotten. He had died, if Craddock remembered rightly, in 1937 or 1938. "He's rather before your time, I expect," said Miss Blacklock. "But you've probably heard of him."
"Oh, yes."
"He was a millionaire, wasn't he?"
"Oh, several times over, though his finances fluctuated. He always risked most of what he made on some new coup."
She spoke with a certain animation, her eyes brightened by memory. "Anyway, he died a very rich man. He had no children. He left his fortune in trust for his wife during her lifetime, and after her death to me absolutely." A vague memory stirred in the inspector's mind.
"Immense fortune to come to faithful secretary, something of that kind."
"For the last 12 years or so," said Miss Blacklock with a slight twinkle, "I've had an excellent motive for murdering Mrs. Girdler. But that doesn't help you, does it?"
"Excuse me for asking this, did Mrs. Girdler resent her husband's disposition of his fortune?"
Miss Blacklock was now looking frankly amused.
"You needn't be so very discreet. What you really mean is, was I Randall Girdler's mistress? No, I wasn't.
I don't think Randall ever gave me a sentimental thought, and I certainly didn't give him one. He was in love with Belle, his wife, and remained in love with her until he died. I think, in all probability, it was gratitude on his part that prompted his making his will. You see, Inspector, in the very early days, when Randall was still on an insecure footing, he came very near to disaster. It was a question of just a few thousands of actual cash. It was a big coup and a very exciting one, daring, as all his schemes were. But he just hadn't got that little bit of cash to tide him over. I came to the rescue. I had a little money of my own. I believed in Randall. I sold every penny I had out and gave it to him. It did the trick. A week later, he was an immensely wealthy man. After that, he treated me more or less as a junior partner. Oh, they were exciting days. She sighed. I enjoyed it all thoroughly. Then my father died, and my only sister was left a hopeless invalid. I had to give it all up and go and look after her. Randall died a couple of years later. I had made quite a lot of money during our association, and I didn't really expect him to leave me anything, but I was very touched, yes, and very proud to find that if Belle predeceased me, and she was one of those delicate creatures whom everyone always says won't live long, I was to inherit his entire fortune. I think, really, the poor man didn't know who to leave it to. Belle's a dear, and she was very delighted about it. She's really a very sweet person. She lives up in Scotland. I haven't seen her for years. We just write at Christmas. You see, I went with my sister to a sanatorium in Switzerland just before the war. She died of consumption out there. She was silent for a moment or two, then said, "I only came back to England just over a year ago." "You said you might be a rich woman very soon. How soon?" "I heard from the nurse attendant who looks after Belle Girdler that Belle is sinking rapidly. It may be only a few weeks." She added sadly, "The money won't mean much to me now. I've got quite enough for my rather simple needs. Once I should have enjoyed playing the markets again, but now, oh, well, one grows old. Still, you do see, Inspector, don't you, that if Patrick and Julia wanted to kill me for a financial reason, they'd be crazy not to wait for another few weeks." "Yes, Miss Blacklock. But what happens if you should predecease Mrs. Girdler? Who does the money go to then?"
"Do you know, I've never really thought. Pip and Emma, I suppose."
Craddock stared, and Miss Blacklock smiled. "Does that sound rather crazy? I believe if I predecease Belle, the money would go to the legal offspring, or whatever the term is, of Randall's only sister, Sonia. Randall had quarrelled with his sister. She married a man whom he considered a crook, and worse."
"And was he a crook?"
"Oh, definitely, I should say. But I believe a very attractive person to women. He was a Greek or a Romanian or something. What was his name now? Stamfordis. Dimitri Stamfordis."
"Randall Girdler cut his sister out of his will when she married this man?"
"Oh, Sonia was a very wealthy woman in her own right. Randall had already settled packets of money on her, as far as possible, in a way so that her husband couldn't touch it. But I believe that when the lawyers urged him to put in someone in case I predeceased Belle, he reluctantly put down Sonia's offspring, simply because he couldn't think of anyone else, and he wasn't the sort of man to leave money to charities."
"And there were children of the marriage?"
"Well, there are Pip and Emma," she laughed. "I know it sounds ridiculous. All I know is that Sonia wrote once to Belle after her marriage, telling her to tell Randall that she was extremely happy and that she had just had twins and was calling them Pip and Emma. As far as I know, she never wrote again. But Bell, of course, may be able to tell you more. Miss Blacklock had been amused by her own recital. The inspector did not look amused. "It comes to this," he said. "If you had been killed the other night, there are presumably at least two people in the world who would have come into a very large fortune. You are wrong, Miss Blacklock, when you say that there is no one who has a motive for desiring your death. There are two people, at least, who are vitally interested. How old would this brother and sister be?" Miss Blacklock frowned. "Oh, let me see, 1922? No, it's difficult to remember. I suppose about 25 or 26. Her face had sobered. "But you surely don't think..." "I think somebody shot at you with the intent to kill you. I think it possible that that same person or persons might try again. I would like you, if you will, to be very careful, Miss Blacklock. One murder has been arranged and did not come off. I think it possible that another murder may be arranged very soon." Philippa Hames straightened her back and pushed back a tendril of hair from her damp forehead. She was cleaning a flower border. "Yes, Inspector?" She looked at him inquiringly. In return, he gave her a rather closer scrutiny than he had done before. "Yes. A good-looking girl. A very English type, with her pale ash-blonde hair and her rather long face. An obstinate chin and mouth. Something of repression, of tautness about her. The eyes were blue, very steady in their glance, and told you nothing at all. The sort of girl, he thought, who would keep a secret well." "I'm sorry always to bother you when you're at work, Mrs. Hames," he said. "But I didn't want to wait until you came back for lunch. Besides, I thought it might be easier to talk to you here, away from little paddocks." "Yes, Inspector?" No emotion, and little interest in the voice. But was there a note of wariness, or did he imagine it? "A certain statement has been made to me this morning. This statement concerns you." Philippa raised her eyebrows very slightly. "You told me, Mrs. Hames, that this man, Rudy Schertz, was quite unknown to you."
"Yes."
"That when you saw him there, dead, it was the first time you had set eyes on him."
"Is that so?" "Certainly. Had never seen him before."
"You did not, for instance, have a conversation with him in the summer house of Little Paddocks?"
"In the summer house?" He was almost sure he caught a note of fear in her voice.
"Yes, Mrs. Hames."
"Who says so?"
"I am told that you had a conversation with this man, Rudy Schertz, and that he asked you where he could hide, and you replied that you would show him, and that a time, 6:15, was definitely mentioned. It would be 6:15, roughly, when Schertz would get here from the bus stop on the evening of the hold-up."
There was a moment's silence.
Then Philippa gave a short, scornful laugh. She looked amused. "Well, I don't know who told you that," she said. "At least, I can guess. It's a very silly, clumsy story. Spiteful, of course. For some reason, Mitzi dislikes me even more than she dislikes the rest of us."
"You deny it?"
"Of course it's not true. I never met or saw Rudy Schertz in my life. And I was nowhere near the house that morning. I was over here, working."
Inspector Craddock said very gently, "Which morning?" There was a momentary pause. Her eyelids flickered.
every morning. I'm here every morning. I don't get away until 1 o'clock. She added scornfully, "It's no good listening to what Mitzi tells you. She tells lies all the time."
"And that's that," said Craddock when he was walking away with Sergeant Fletcher. "Two young women whose stories flatly contradict each other. Which one am I to believe?"
"Everyone seems to agree that this foreign girl tells whoppers," said Fletcher. "It's been my experience in dealing with aliens that lying comes more easy than truth-telling. Seems to be clear she's got a spite against this Mrs. Hames."
"So, if you were me, you'd believe Mrs. Hames?"
"Unless you've got reason to think otherwise, sir."
And Craddock hadn't, not really. Only the remembrance of a pair of oversteady blue eyes and the glib enunciation of the words "that morning." For, to the best of his recollection, he hadn't said whether the interview in the summer house had taken place in the morning or the afternoon. Still, Miss Blacklock, or if not Miss Blacklock, certainly Miss Bunner might have mentioned the visit of the young foreigner who had come to catch his fare back to Switzerland, and Philippa Hames might have, therefore, assumed that the conversation was supposed to have taken place on that particular morning. But Craddock still thought that there had been a note of fear in her voice as she asked, "In the summer house?" He decided to keep an open mind on the subject. It was very pleasant in the vicarage garden. One of those sudden spells of autumn warmth had descended upon England. Inspector Craddock could never remember if it was St. Martin's or St. Luke's summer, but he knew that it was very pleasant, and also very enervating. He sat in a deck chair provided for him by an energetic Bunch, just on her way to her mother's meeting, and, well protected with shawls and a large rug round her knees, Miss Marple sat knitting beside him. The sunshine, the peace, the steady click of Miss Marple's knitting needles all combined to produce a soporific feeling in the inspector. And yet, at the same time, there was a nightmarish feeling at the back of his mind. It was like a familiar dream where an undertone of menace grows and finally turns ease into terror. He said abruptly, "You oughtn't to be here." Miss Marple's needles stopped clicking for a moment. Her placid china-blue eyes regarded him thoughtfully. She said, "I know what you mean. You're a very conscientious boy, but it's perfectly all right. Bunch's father, he was vicar of our parish, a very fine scholar, and her mother, who is a most remarkable woman, real spiritual power, are very old friends of mine. It's the most natural thing in the world that when I'm at Medenham I should come on here to stay with Bunch for a little."
"Oh, perhaps," said Craddock, but don't snoop around. I've a feeling, I have really, that it isn't safe." Miss Marple smiled a little.
"But I'm afraid," she said, "that we old women always do snoop. It would be very odd and much more noticeable if I didn't. Questions about mutual friends in different parts of the world, and whether they remember so-and-so, and do they remember who it was that Lady Somebody's daughter married, all that helps, doesn't it?"
"Helps?" said the inspector rather stupidly.
"Helps to find out if people are who they say they are," said Miss Marple. She went on, "Because that's what's worrying you, isn't it? And that's really the particular way the world has changed since the war. Take this place, Chipping Cleghorn, for instance. It's very much like St. Mary Mead, where I live. 15 years ago, one knew who everybody was. The Bantrys in the big house, and the Hartnells, and the Price Ridleys, and the Weatherbys.
They were people whose fathers and mothers and grandfathers and grandmothers, or whose aunts and uncles, had lived there before them. If somebody new came to live there, they brought letters of introduction. Or they'd been in the same regiment or served on the same ship as someone there already. If anybody new, really new, really a stranger came, well, they stuck out. Everybody wondered about them and didn't rest until they found out. She nodded her head gently. But it's not like that anymore. Every village and small country place is full of people who've just come and settled there without any ties to bring them. The big houses have been sold, and the cottages have been converted and changed. And people just come, and all you know about them is what they say of themselves. They've come, you see, from all over the world. People from India, and Hong Kong, and China, and people who used to live in France and Italy in little cheap places and on islands, and people who've made a little money and can afford to retire. But nobody knows any more who anyone is. You can have Benares brassware in your house and talk about Tiffin and Chota Hazri. And you can have pictures of Taormina and talk about the English church and the library. Like Miss Hinchcliffe and Miss Murgatroyd. You can come from the south of France or have spent your life in the east. People take you at your own valuation. They don't wait to call until they've had a letter from a friend saying that the so-and-sos are delightful people and she's known them all their lives. And that, thought Craddock, was exactly what was oppressing him. He didn't know. They were just faces and personalities, and they were backed up by ration books and identity cards, nice, neat identity cards with numbers on them, without photographs or fingerprints. Anybody who took the trouble could have a suitable identity card, and partly because of that, the subtler links that had held together English social rural life had fallen apart. In a town, nobody expected to know his neighbour. In the country now, nobody knew his neighbour either, though possibly he still thought he did. Because of the oiled door, Craddock knew that there had been somebody in Letitia Blacklock's drawing-room who was not the pleasant, friendly country neighbour he or she pretended to be. And because of that, he was afraid for Miss Marple, who was frail and old, and who noticed things. He said, "We can, to a certain extent, check up on these people." But he knew that that wasn't so easy. India and China and Hong Kong and the south of France. It wasn't as easy as it would have been 15 years ago. There were people, as he knew only too well, who were going about the country with borrowed identities. Borrowed from people who had met sudden death by incidents in the cities. There were organisations who bought up identities, who faked identity and ration cards. There were 100 small rackets springing into being. You could check up, but it would take time, and time was what he hadn't got because Randall Girdler's widow was very near death. It was then that, worried and tired, lulled by the sunshine, he told Miss Marple about Randall Girdler and about Pip and Emma. "Just a couple of names," he said. "Nicknames at that. They mayn't exist. They may be respectable citizens living in Europe somewhere. On the other hand, one or both of them may be here in Chipping Cleghorn. 25 years old, approximately. Who filled that description?" He said, thinking aloud,
That nephew and niece of hers, or cousins, or whatever they are. I wonder when she saw them last. Miss Marple said gently, "I'll find out for you, shall I?"
"Now, please, Miss Marple, don't..."
"It will be quite simple, Inspector. You really need not worry. And it won't be noticeable if I do it, because, you see, it won't be official. If there is anything wrong, you don't want to put them on their guard." Pip and Emma, thought Craddock. Pip and Emma. He was getting obsessed by Pip and Emma. That attractive, daredevil young man. The good-looking girl with the cool stare. He said, "I may find out more about them in the next 48 hours. I'm going up to Scotland. Mrs. Girdler, if she's able to talk, may know a good deal more about them."
"I think that's a very wise move." Miss Marple hesitated. "I hope," she murmured, "that you have warned Miss Blacklock to be careful."
"I've warned her, yes. And I shall leave a man here to keep an unobtrusive eye on things." He avoided Miss Marple's eye, which said plainly enough that a policeman keeping an eye on things would be little good if the danger was in the family circle. "And remember," said Craddock, looking squarely at her, "I've warned you."
"I assure you, Inspector," said Miss Marple, "that I can take care of myself."
Chapter 11. Miss Marple comes to tea. If Letitia Blacklock seemed slightly absent-minded when Mrs. Harmon came to tea and brought a guest who was staying with her, Miss Marple, the guest in question, was hardly likely to notice the fact, since it was the first time she had met her. The old lady was very charming in her gentle, gossipy fashion. She revealed herself almost at once to be one of those old ladies who have a constant preoccupation with burglars.
"They can get in anywhere, my dear," she assured her hostess. "Absolutely anywhere nowadays. So many new American methods. I myself pin my faith to a very old-fashioned device, a cabin hook and eye. They can pick locks and draw back bolts, but a brass hook and eye defeats them. Have you ever tried that?"
"I'm afraid we're not very good at bolts and bars," said Miss Blacklock cheerfully. "There's really nothing much to burgle."
"A chain on the front door," Miss Marple advised. "Then the maid need only open it a crack and see who is there, and they can't force their way in."
"I expect Mitzi, our middle European, would love that."
"The hold-up you had must have been very, very frightening," said Miss Marple. "Bunch has been telling me all about it."
"I was scared stiff," said Bunch. "It was an alarming experience," admitted Miss Blacklock.
"It really seems like providence that the man tripped himself up and shot himself. These burglars are so violent nowadays. How did he get in?"
"Well, I'm afraid we don't lock our doors much."
"Oh, Letty," exclaimed Miss Bunner. "I forgot to tell you, the inspector was most peculiar this morning. He insisted on opening the second door, you know, the one that's never been opened, the one over there. He hunted for the key and everything and said the door had been oiled. But I can't see why, because..."
Too late, she got Miss Blacklock's signal to be quiet, and paused open-mouthed.
"Oh, Lottie, I'm so sorry. I mean, Oh, I do beg your pardon, Letty. Oh, dear. Oh, how stupid I am."
"It doesn't matter," said Miss Blacklock. But she was annoyed. "Only I don't think Inspector Craddock wants that talked about." "I didn't know you had been there when he was experimenting, Dora. You do understand, don't you, Mrs. Harmon?"
"Oh, yes," said Bunch.
"We won't breathe a word, will we, Aunt Jane?
But I wonder why he..."
She relapsed into thought. Miss Bunner fidgeted and looked miserable, bursting out at last,
"I always say the wrong thing. Oh, dear, I'm nothing but a trial to you, Letty."
Miss Blacklock said quickly, "You're my great comfort, Dora. And anyway, in a small place like Chipping Cleghorn, there aren't really any secrets.
Now that is very true, said Miss Marple. I'm afraid, you know, that things do get round in the most extraordinary way. Servants, of course. And yet it can't only be that, because one has so few servants nowadays. Still, there are the daily women, and perhaps they're worse, because they go to everybody in turn and pass the news round.
Oh, said Bunch Harmon suddenly. I've got it. Of course, if that door could open too, someone might have gone out of here in the dark and done the hold-up. Only, of course, they didn't, because it was the man from the Royal Spa Hotel, or wasn't it? No, I don't see after all. She frowned.
Did it all happen in this room, then? Asked Miss Marple, adding apologetically, I'm afraid you must think me sadly curious, Miss Blacklock, but it really is so very exciting. It's just like something one reads about in the paper. And actually to have happened to someone one knows. I'm just longing to hear all about it and to picture it all, if you know what I mean. Immediately Miss Marple received a confused and voluble account from Bunch and Miss Bunner, with occasional emendations and corrections from Miss Blacklock. In the middle of it, Patrick came in and good-naturedly entered into the spirit of the recital, going so far as to enact himself the part of Rudy Schertz. And Aunt Letty was there, in the corner by the archway. Go and stand there, Aunt Letty. Miss Blacklock obeyed, and then Miss Marple was shown the actual bullet holes.
What a marvellous, what a providential escape, she gasped.
I was just going to offer my guest cigarettes. Miss Blacklock indicated the big silver box on the table.
People are always so careless when they smoke, said Miss Bunner disapprovingly. Nobody really respects good furniture as they used to. Look at the horrid burn somebody made on this beautiful table by putting a cigarette down on it. It's disgraceful.
Miss Blacklock sighed. Sometimes, I'm afraid, one thinks too much of one's possessions.
But it's such a lovely table, Letty.
Miss Bunner loved her friend's possessions with as much fervour as though they had been her own. Bunch Harmon had always thought it was a very endearing trait in her. She showed no sign of envy.
It is a lovely table, said Miss Marple politely. And what a very pretty china lamp on it.
Again, it was Miss Bunner who accepted the compliment as though she and not Miss Blacklock was the owner of the lamp.
Isn't it delightful? Dresden. There's a pair of them. The other's in the spare room, I think.
You know where everything is in this house, Dora. Or you think you do, said Miss Blacklock good-humouredly. You care far more about my things than I do. Miss Bunner flushed.
I do like nice things, she said.
Her voice was half defiant, half wistful.
I must confess, said Miss Marple, that my own few possessions are very dear to me, too. So many memories, you know. It's the same with photographs. People nowadays have so few photographs about. Now, I like to keep all the pictures of my nephews and nieces as babies, and then as children, and so on.
You've got a horrible one of me, aged 3, said Bunch, holding a fox terrier and squinting.
I expect your aunt has many photographs of you, said Miss Marple, turning to Patrick.
Oh, we're only distant cousins, said Patrick. I believe Eleanor did send me one of you as a baby, Pat, said Miss Blacklock, but I'm afraid I didn't keep it. I'd really forgotten how many children she'd had or what their names were until she wrote me about you two being over here.
Another sign of the times, said Miss Marple. Nowadays, one so often doesn't know one's younger relations at all. In the old days, with all the big family reunions, that would have been impossible.
I last saw Pat and Julia's mother at a wedding 30 years ago, said Miss Blacklock. She was a very pretty girl. That's why she has such handsome children, said Patrick with a grin.
You've got a marvellous old album, said Julia. Do you remember, Aunt Letty? We looked through it the other day. The hats!
"And how smart we thought ourselves," said Miss Blacklock with a sigh. "Never mind, Aunt Letty," said Patrick. "Julia will come across a snapshot of herself in about 30 years' time, and won't she think she looks a guy?" "Did you do that on purpose?" said Bunch, as she and Miss Marple were walking home. "Talk about photographs, I mean." "Well, my dear, it is interesting to know that Miss Blacklock didn't know either of her two young relatives by sight. Yes. I think Inspector Craddock will be interested to hear that."
Chapter 12. Morning Activities in Chipping Cleghorn. Edmund Swettenham sat down rather precariously on a garden roller.
"Good morning, Philippa," he said.
"Hello.
Are you very busy?"
"Moderately.
What are you doing?"
"Can't you see?"
"No. I'm not a gardener. You seem to be playing with earth in some fashion."
"I'm pricking out winter lettuce."
"Pricking out? What a curious term. Like pinking. Do you know what pinking is? I only learnt the other day. I always thought it was a term for professional duelling."
"Do you want anything in particular?" asked Philippa coldly.
"Yes.
I want to see you."
Philippa gave him a quick glance.
"I wish you wouldn't come here like this. Mrs. Lucas won't like it."
"Doesn't she allow you to have followers?"
"Don't be absurd."
"Followers. That's another nice word. It describes my attitude perfectly. Respectful at a distance, but firmly pursuing."
"Please go away, Edmund. You've no business to come here."
"You're wrong," said Edmund triumphantly. "I have business here. Mrs. Lucas rang up my mamma this morning and said she had a good many vegetable marrows.
Oh, masses of them.
And would we like to exchange a pot of honey for a vegetable marrow or so?"
"That's not fair exchange at all. Vegetable marrows are quite unsaleable at the moment. Everybody has such a lot."
"Naturally. That's why Mrs. Lucas rang up. Last time, if I remember rightly, the exchange suggested was some skim milk, mark you, in exchange for some lettuces. It was then very early in the season for lettuces. They were about a shilling each."
Philippa did not speak.
Edmund tugged at his pocket and extracted a pot of honey. "So here," he said, "is my alibi. Used in a loose and quite indefensible meaning of the term. If Mrs. Lucas pops her bust round the door of the potting shed, I am here in quest of vegetable marrows. There is absolutely no question of dalliance."
"I see."
"Do you ever read Tennyson?" inquired Edmund conversationally.
"Not very often."
"You should. Tennyson is shortly going to make a comeback in a big way. When you turn on your wireless in the evening, it will be the Idylls of the King you will hear, and not Interminable Trollope." "I always thought the Trollope pose was the most unbearable affectation. Perhaps a little of Trollope, but not to drown in him. But speaking of Tennyson, have you read Maud?"
"Once, long ago."
"It's got some points about it."
He quoted softly, "Faultily faultless, icily regular, splendidly null."
"That's you, Philippa." "It was hardly a compliment." "No, it wasn't meant to be. I gather Maud got under the poor fellow's skin just like you've got under mine."
"Oh, don't be absurd, Edmund."
"Oh, hell, Philippa. Why are you like you are? And what goes on behind your splendidly regular features? What do you think? What do you feel? Are you happy, or miserable, or frightened, or what? There must be something."
Philippa said quietly, "What I feel is my own business."
"It's mine, too. I want to make you talk. I want to know what goes on in that quiet head of yours. I've a right to know. I have, really. I didn't want to fall in love with you. I wanted to sit quietly and write my book.
such a nice book all about how miserable the world is. It's frightfully easy to be clever about how miserable everybody is, and it's all a habit, really. Yes, I've suddenly become convinced of that after reading A Life of Burne Jones. Philippa had stopped pricking out. She was staring at him with a puzzled frown. What has Burne Jones got to do with it? Everything. When you've read all about the Pre-Raphaelites, you realise just what fashion is. They were all terrifically hearty and slangy and jolly and laughed and joked and everything was fine and wonderful. That was fashion, too. They weren't any happier or heartier than we are. And we are not any more miserable than they were. It's all fashion, I tell you. After the last war, we went in for sex. Now it's all frustration. None of it matters. Oh, why are we talking about all this? I started out to talk about us, only I got cold feet and shied off. Because you won't help me. What do you want me to do? Talk. Tell me things. Is it your husband? Do you adore him and he's dead and you shut up like a clam? Is that it? All right, you adored him and he's dead. Well, other girls' husbands are dead, lots of them. And some of the girls love their husbands. They tell you so in bars and cry a bit when they're drunk enough and then want to go to bed with you so that they'll feel better. It's one way of getting over it, I suppose. You've got to get over it, Philippa. You're young and you're extremely lovely, and I love you like hell. Talk about your damned husband. Tell me about him. There's nothing to tell. We met and got married. You must have been very young. Too young. Then you weren't happy with him? Go on, Philippa. There's nothing to go on about. We were married. We were as happy as most people are, I suppose. Harry was born. Ronald went overseas. He was killed in Italy. And now there's Harry. And now there's Harry. I like Harry. He's a really nice kid. He likes me. We get on. What about it, Philippa? Shall we get married? You can go on gardening, and I can go on writing my book, and in the holidays we'll leave off working and enjoy ourselves. We can manage with tact, not to have to live with Mother. She can fork out a bit to support her adored son. I sponge, I write tripey books, I have defective eyesight, and I talk too much. But that's the worst. Will you try it? Philippa looked at him. She saw a tall, rather solemn young man with an anxious face and large spectacles. His sandy head was rumpled, and he was regarding her with a reassuring friendliness. No, said Philippa. Definitely no? Definitely no. Why? You don't know anything about me. Is that all? No. You don't know anything about anything. Edmund considered. Perhaps not, he admitted. But who does? Philippa, my adored one, he broke off. A shrill and prolonged yapping was rapidly approaching. Peaks in the High Hall garden, said Edmund, when twilight was falling, only it's 11 a.m. Phil, 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 they were crying and calling. Your name doesn't lend itself to the rhythm, does it? Sounds like an ode to a fountain pen. Have you got another name? Joan. Please, go away. That's Mrs. Lucas. Joan, 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 Joan. Better, but still not good. When greasy Joan the pot doth keel. Well, that's not a nice picture of married life either. Mrs. Lucas. Oh, hell, said Edmund. Get me a blasted vegetable marrow. Sergeant Fletcher had the house at Little Paddock's to himself. It was Mitzi's day off. She always went by the 11 o'clock bus into Medenham Wells. By arrangement with Miss Blacklock, Sergeant Fletcher had the run of the house. She and Dora Bunner had gone down to the village. Fletcher worked fast.
Someone in the house had oiled and prepared that door, and whoever had done it in order to be able to leave the drawing room unnoticed as soon as the lights went out. That ruled out Mitzi, who wouldn't have needed to use the door. Who was left? The neighbours, Fletcher thought, might also be ruled out. He didn't see how they could have found an opportunity to oil and prepare the door. That left Patrick and Julia Simmons, Philippa Hames, and possibly Dora Bunner. The young Simmons were in Milchester. Philippa Hames was at work. Sergeant Fletcher was free to search out any secrets he could. But the house was disappointingly innocent. Fletcher, who was an expert on electricity, could find nothing suggestive in the wiring or pertinences of the electric fixtures to show how the lights had been fused. Making a rapid survey of the household bedrooms, he found an irritating normality. In Philippa Hames' room were photographs of a small boy with serious eyes, an earlier photo of the same child, a pile of schoolboy letters, a theatre programme or two. In Julia's room there was a drawer full of snapshots of the south of France, bathing photos, a villa set amidst mimosa. Patrick's held some souvenirs of naval days. Dora Bunner's held few personal possessions, and they seemed innocent enough. And yet, thought Fletcher, someone in the house must have oiled that door. His thoughts broke off at a sound below stairs. He went quickly to the top of the staircase and looked down. Mrs. Swettenham was crossing the hall. She had a basket on her arm. She looked into the drawing room, crossed the hall, and went into the dining room. She came out again without the basket. Some faint sound that Fletcher made, a board that creaked unexpectedly under his feet, made her turn her head. She called up, "Is that you, Miss Blacklock?" "No, Mrs. Swettenham. It's me," said Fletcher. Mrs. Swettenham gave a faint scream. "Oh, how you startled me. I thought it might be another burglar." Fletcher came down the stairs. "This house doesn't seem to be very well protected against burglars," he said. "Can anybody always walk in and out just as they like?" "I just brought up some of my quinces," explained Mrs. Swettenham. "Miss Blacklock wants to make quince jelly, and she hasn't got a quince tree here. I left them in the dining room." Then she smiled. "Oh, I see. You mean how did I get in? Well, I just came in through the side door. We all walk in and out of each other's houses, Sergeant. Nobody dreams of locking a door until it's dark. I mean, it would be so awkward, wouldn't it, if you brought things and couldn't get in to leave them? It's not like the old days when you rang a bell and a servant always came to answer it." Mrs. Swettenham sighed. "In India, I remember," she said mournfully, "we had 18 servants, 18, not counting the ayah. Just as a matter of course. And at home, when I was a girl, we always had 3. Although Mother always felt it was terribly poverty-stricken not to be able to afford a kitchen-maid. I must say I find life very odd nowadays, Sergeant. Though I know one mustn't complain. So much worse for the miners, always getting psittacosis or is that parrot disease? And having to come out of the mines and try to be gardeners, though they don't know weeds from spinach." She added, as she tripped towards the door, "I mustn't keep you. I expect you're very busy. Nothing else is going to happen, is it?"
"Why should it, Mrs. Swettenham?"
"I just wondered, seeing you here. I thought it might be a gang. You'll tell Miss Blacklock about the quinces, won't you?"
Mrs. Swettenham departed. Fletcher felt like a man who has received an unexpected jolt. He had been assuming, erroneously, he now perceived, that it must have been someone in the house who had done the oiling of the door. He saw now that he was wrong. An outsider had only to wait until Mitzi had departed by bus, and Letitia Blacklock and Dora Bunner were both out of the house. Such an opportunity must have been simplicity itself. That meant that he couldn't rule out anybody who had been in the drawing-room that night.
"Murgatroyd?"
"Yes, Hinch?"
"I've been doing a bit of thinking."
"Have you, Hinch?"
Yet the great brain has been working. You know, Murgatroyd, the whole set-up the other evening was decidedly fishy.
Fishy?
Yes. Tuck your hair up, Murgatroyd, and take this trowel. Pretend it's a revolver.
Oh,
said Miss Murgatroyd nervously. All right, it won't bite you. Now come along to the kitchen door. You're going to be the burglar. You stand here. Now, you're going into the kitchen to hold up a lot of nitwits. Take the torch. Switch it on.
But it's broad daylight.
Use your imagination, Murgatroyd. Switch it on. Miss Murgatroyd did so, rather clumsily, shifting the trowel under one arm while she did so. Now then, said Miss Hinchcliffe, off you go. Remember the time you played Hermia in Midsummer Night's Dream at the Women's Institute? Act. Give it all you've got. Stick 'em up. Those are your lines. And don't ruin them by saying please. Obediently, Miss Murgatroyd raised her torch, flourished the trowel, and advanced on the kitchen door. Transferring the torch to her right hand, she swiftly turned the handle and stepped forward, resuming the torch in her left hand.
Stick 'em up,
she fluted, adding vexedly, dear me, this is very difficult, Hinge. Why?
The door. It's a swing door. It keeps coming back, and I've got both hands full.
Exactly, boomed Miss Hinchcliffe. And the drawing-room door at Little Paddock's always swings, too. It isn't a swing door like this, but it won't stay open. That's why Letty Blacklock bought that absolutely delectable heavy glass doorstop from Elliot's in the High Street. I don't mind saying I've never forgiven her for getting in ahead of me there. I was beating the old brute down from 8 guineas to £6.10. Then Blacklock comes along and buys the damn thing. I'd never seen as attractive a doorstop. You don't often get those glass bubbles in that big size.
Well, perhaps the burglar put the doorstop against the door to keep it open, suggested Miss Murgatroyd.
Oh, use your common sense, Murgatroyd. What does he do? Throw open the door, say, excuse me a moment, stoop and put the stop into position, and then resume business by saying, hands up? Try holding the door with your shoulder.
It's still very awkward, complained Miss Murgatroyd.
Exactly, said Miss Hinchcliffe. A revolver, a torch, and a door to hold open. A bit too much, isn't it? So, what's the answer?
Miss Murgatroyd did not attempt to supply an answer. She looked inquiringly and admiringly at her masterful friend and waited to be enlightened.
We know he'd got a revolver because he fired it, said Miss Hinchcliffe. And we know he had a torch because we all saw it. That is, unless we're all victims of mass hypnotism, like explanations of the Indian rope trick. What a bore that old Easterbrook is with his Indian stories. So the question is, did someone hold that door open for him?
But who could have done that?
Well, you could have for one, Murgatroyd. As far as I remember, you were standing directly behind it when the lights went out. Miss Hinchcliffe laughed heartily. Highly suspicious character, aren't you, Murgatroyd? But who'd think it to look at you? Here, give me that trowel. Thank heavens it isn't really a revolver. You'd have shot yourself by now.
It's a most extraordinary thing, muttered Colonel Easterbrook. Most extraordinary. Laura?
Yes, darling?
Come into my dressing room a moment.
What is it, darling?
Mrs. Easterbrook appeared through the open door.
Remember my showing you that revolver of mine?
Oh, yes, Archie. Nasty, horrid black thing.
Yes, Hun souvenir. Was in this drawer, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
Well, it's not there now.
Archie, how extraordinary.
You haven't moved it or anything?
Oh, no. I'd never dare to touch the horrid thing.
Think old Mother Watson named it?
Oh, I shouldn't think so for a minute. Mrs. Butt would never do a thing like that. Shall I ask her?
No, no, better not. Don't want to start a lot of talk. Tell me, do you remember when it was I showed it to you?
Oh,
About a week ago. You were grumbling about your collars and the laundry, and you opened this drawer wide, and there it was at the back, and I asked you what it was.
Yes, that's right. About a week ago. You don't remember the date?
Mrs. Easterbrook considered, eyelids down over her eyes, a shrewd brain working.
Of course, she said. It was Saturday, the day we were to have gone into the pictures, but we didn't.
Sure it wasn't before that? Wednesday? Thursday? Or even the week before that again?
No, dear, said Mrs. Easterbrook. I remember quite distinctly. It was Saturday the 30th. It just seems a long time because of all the trouble there's been. And I can tell you how I remember. It's because it was the day after the hold-up at Miss Blacklock's, because when I saw your revolver, it reminded me of the shooting the night before.
Ah, said Colonel Easterbrook. Then that's a great load off my mind.
Oh, Archie, why?
Just because if that revolver had disappeared before the shooting, well, it might possibly have been my revolver that was pinched by that Swiss fellow.
But how would he have known you had one?
These gangs have a most extraordinary communication service. They get to know everything about a place and who lives there.
What a lot you know, Archie.
Ah, yes. Seen a thing or two in my time. Still, as you definitely remember seeing my revolver after the hold-up, well, that settles it. The revolver that Swiss fellow used can't have been mine, can it?
Of course it can't.
Great relief. I should have had to go to the police about it, and they ask a lot of awkward questions, won't you? As a matter of fact, I never took out a license for it. Somehow, after a war, one forgets these peacetime regulations. I looked on it as a war souvenir, not as a firearm.
Yes, I see, of course.
But, all the same, where on earth can the damn thing be?
Perhaps Mrs. Butt took it. She always seemed quite honest. But perhaps she felt nervous after the hold-up and thought she'd like to have a revolver in the house. Of course, she'll never admit doing that. I shan't even ask her. She might get offended. And what should we do then? This is such a big house, I simply couldn't...
Quite so, said Colonel Easterbrook.
Better not say anything.